Today's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Shudder. Brought to you by AMC Networks, Shudder is not only a premium streaming video service, but an experience unlike any other. Created for fans of all degrees of thriller, suspense, and horror, Shudder is home to the largest and fastest-growing human-curated selection of high-quality, spine-tingling, and provocative films, TV series, and originals. There's always something new and unexpected for Shudder members to explore. Premiering on Shudder this week is the critically acclaimed dark comedy Mon Monsters. While doing a school-mandated community service, a bullied boy and his tormentors discover a creature. Claiming her for their own, the kids keep the creature captive, revealing the monster within themselves as her ferocious sister scours the city in search of her missing sibling. Mon Monsters is a wild, left-of-center coming-of-age story with horror, gore, and dark comedy. Variety calls Mon Monsters savagely funny, a social horror movie. Find out for yourself today, streaming only on Shudder. Shudder is available for $4.99 a month or $49.99 with an annual membership. But our listeners can get a free month by entering promo code SHOCK at checkout. Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of thrillers, suspense, and horror available to stream anywhere.
This week's Shockwaves is also sponsored by Wellgo USA and their newest remastered Blu-ray release of Ichi the Killer. Simon Abrams at RogerEbert.com says you won't find better conditions to watch Ichi the Killer under. Takeshi Miike's Ichi the Killer has endured as one of the most influential pieces of genre filmmaking of the last two decades, and now it returns in a stunning, all-new, digitally restored special edition approved by Miike himself. Ichi the Killer Definitive Remastered Edition available now on Blu-ray and digital at Amazon.com from Wellgo USA. For more info, visit www.wellgousa.com.
And just a reminder, we still have a few days left in voting for the Rondo Awards, which we are nominated under number 18 for Best Multimedia Site, which is kind of what we are, I guess.
Kind of awesome.
But either way, we appreciate the vote from you guys. It's something that would be exciting to bring it. Shockwaves hasn't won this, even though we've been nominated, I think, for the last 2 years. So you go on there, you'll figure out how to use the form. Rob, do you want to weigh in on that?
It's rondoaward.com. And then you click to enter the site, and basically all you have to do is copy and paste the email, taraco@AOL.com. It's taraco@AOL.com. Just put in 18 and vote for Shockwaves. You don't have to do all of them.
But as big fans of all the horror stuff going on in the year, it'd be awesome if you took the time to do it.
Great. And also a reminder that 3/4 of the Shockwaves crew will be at the Chattanooga Film Festival. Sorry, Ryan. We'll miss you.
No. I'll follow that up with something else.
All of those officially nominated for Rondo. As the unofficial.
This is taking place from April 5th to the 8th. And there's a whole ton of great movies, shorts, events. We're doing a live Shockwaves there. Becca is premiering her movie. We're looking forward to meeting you guys there. And can I say our guest on Shockwaves?
Yeah, definitely.
We will be joined by Joe Bob Briggs on Shockwaves
so
in Chattanooga.
To talk about weird movies. I mean, how fun will that be?
The weirdest movies Joe Bob Briggs has ever seen.
So get the info at chatfilmfest.org. That's chattfilmfest.org.
And hey, kids, if you're going to the Overlook Film Festival, 1/4 of Shockwaves will be there.
Non-Rondo affiliate.
Blumhouse is going to be bringing Unfriended Dark Web and Upgrade, but I'm going to do a very special discussion with one of the Overlook guests to be determined. So if
when
you're
is
going
that?
It is mid-April.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's
longest
in New Orleans.
Opening ever. Okay, and welcome to Shockwaves episode 90. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galuzzo, sitting here with Elric Kane.
Oh, boy. I feel like I've got a lot to talk about this week.
Do
I'm
you?
Kind of excited.
Really?
A lot of stuff, yeah.
All right.
I don't know what happened.
I'm excited.
I think I'm bouncing back after a quiet week, yeah.
I mean, it's not like you had a lot to talk about on your three-hour retrospective of Carpenter's career.
I actually, that's the first
time.
You didn't
run out of steam.
That
I'll be
amazing,
honest.
Amazing, by the way.
First time I felt guilty about having, because I never feel guilty about having the other show. That time, I got to admit, it took about 3 weeks of me watching a lot of stuff for that where I wasn't doing my due diligence here. So I apologize, but it was for Carpenter. So I think
love
it's
it because it's only part one of part two.
One is 3 hours.
And I have literally been listening to it every day on my way to and from work.
You
and
get
I've
through
still
one,
got
one movie.
Show left.
It's like an audiobook.
I will say my favorite thing
it's
about
like it.
It
was a challenge, and now this.
The good thing about it is the thing we've had the most reaction to is people saying that they rewatched or are rewatching Christine because of it. And I'm like, that is fucking rad. Because I did that,
great.
And I kind of fell in love and got so excited with it. And so it's cool.
Yeah. All right, you're not the only one that hosts this.
I know.
We also have Ryan Turek here.
Yeah, I'm only sitting next to Elric. Hi, everybody.
Hello, and Rebecca McKendry.
We're all wearing black t-shirts today. It's weird me out, guys.
What's different?
Go figure.
That?
All black.
I don't usually wear black.
And Becca's still alive. This is good.
Yes.
Thanks, guys.
We had another scare.
Yeah. I spent another weekend in the hospital. But I read graphic novels this time. And I'm calling them that because I buy them in graphic novel form, not comic book form.
Wow.
So thank you, guys.
And you discovered that peppercorns are not actually...
Yeah,
pepper.
Red peppercorns are actually cashews. The more you fucking know, it keeps you alive, apparently.
I mean, is that just like... 99-cent store peppercorns?
No,
or is
this
that Whole
this
Foods
was like,
peppercorns?
No, this
or
was like the fancy Penzies, which is like a spice company. This was the Penzies pepper mill like blended corns. Huh. And so you get the black ones, the white ones,
what
and
the fuck peppercorns?
The red ones. I know, and it did not even have like a nut warning on there. But
I did not know that.
Red peppercorns are not actually peppercorns.
Wow.
They are cashews.
Was
nothing to do with horror.
Was your reaction as bad as if you had just eaten a nut? Or
yes.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah. Yes, both times.
Well, that's
like,
well, real life horror. That's
Thing.
The second time, the first time it got really fucking bad because I didn't know what was going on. When it happened the second time, I was able to say, it's happening again. And the only thing that was common from both meals was the pepper.
That's good.
And
you deduced.
So I got epi'd twice in 2 weeks and I'm all hyped up on prednisone now. So let's do this shit, boys.
All right.
Wow.
Well, that's an intro. We are ready to roll.
Yeah. So I had a fun little topic I wanted to riff on before we got into it. So I was catching up with our good friend Spooky Dan Walker.
Yes.
And I jumped in the car with him, and we were just talking about whatever. And he was listening to our show, okay? But here's the thing. Now, if you know Spooky personally, and forgive me, Spooky, for divulging this, but Spooky lives solely on Red Bull and cloves.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he consumes food, but these are the two things that
I've seen him eat pancakes.
Okay, so he eats food occasionally,
yeah.
But it's mostly Red Bull. He also has, forgive me again, not the greatest attention span. And so
he'll admit that.
He listens to our podcast at 2 times the speed that it's supposed to be. Now, I've listened to an audiobook at half a speed faster. After that, I can't understand anything. But he was listening at 2 times the speed to our show, which I found so bizarre. And he's like, it's not so bad. I just can't understand Elric. He's too fast for too fast. And so I started
laughing.
He can
never go fast enough.
And then I was like, okay, wait a minute. So you listen to all your podcasts this way? And he's like, actually, funny story. I listened to the Movie Crypt at 2 times the speed. And I'm so used to it that the last time I saw Adam Green, he was talking too slow to be in person. And I started laughing out loud.
That's
he's like,
good.
It literally felt like he was talking in slow. Because he has now conditioned his brain that we all talk at this speed.
Well, how about for him? I just start talking like this.
And then I pulled out because Ryan did a video maybe a year ago, which I may reshare for this episode, where you listened to our show at half speed slower.
And it was trippy.
And it sounded like we were drunk.
Yeah. And Becca's like, no way.
And it was wonderful.
Yeah.
Really hilarious.
Job
so I guess my question to our audience out there is, if you listen to a lot of podcasts especially, do you try to squeeze in more podcasts by listening at faster? It is an option, though. That's the thing. You can go at half the speed, 1 speed, 2 times faster.
What was that?
How many podcasts?
I would never do this. But what made me laugh was the fact that he couldn't talk to Adam Green in real life.
So do we always sound like chipmunks in Dan's head? Like,
yes.
Do we just always sound like that now?
Elric is a blur because Elric already talks fast as it is.
Yeah. It's just
they need a function where you can choose who you slow down and who you speed up.
But I laughed at all this. He's like, it's not so bad if you concentrate. And I'm like, but I don't want to concentrate in the car on what Elric's trying to say.
That's weird.
I just thought it was hilarious, and I'm curious. I mean, you don't do
how
this.
Many? No, I don't do this. How many podcasts do you have to listen to go, you know what? My time management sucks. I need to amplify and speed these things up.
There are podcasts. No, there are podcasts that I've listened to that I felt moved too slow, and I knew that it was for like tension or pacing. Like specifically, some of the episodes of Lore, I was like, just get on with it. But never once did I say,
but that's
I'm
like
just
a produced show.
Yeah.
So you'd lose sound effects and shit would get distorted. Yeah.
So
that's
like,
worse.
I would never have sped it up. But yeah, that's one where I'm just like, let's move it along now. Yeah. But
well, I've got to say, or to be really quick, take that, Speedy.
Well, here
that's like at the end of those car commercials on the radio.
Micro Machines, too.
We can now call him Speedy Dan.
No, ARP.
Speedy,
California.
Speedy Dan. The new nickname is born, Speedy Dan.
Yeah, as far as I've gone, is audiobooks, I'll listen to slightly fast, one half a bit faster. To,
like Game of Thrones or so. That would make sense, I guess, to an extent.
And I believe Speedy Dan will be joining us in Texas, right? At least his film will.
Oh, is he here?
Yes, okay. yes, for sure.
That's an interesting. What's interesting, none of us do. I'm just curious why the function was created in the first place. Was it for people to get through things faster? Or?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, I'll be honest. When I downloaded it, the audiobook of it with Steve Weber, it tells you, your app tells you, this is a 42-hour listen. Mm-hmm. Or at half speed, you know, half speed faster, 36 hours. And I'm like, ooh, that's a whole, like, you know.
Oh, wow.
Several hours I could save. And so I was like, all right. And I listened to a few variations to make sure I didn't lose anything in terms of like being able to actually listen to it. But I don't know. It made me laugh, the whole real life thing. I think he said he heard a theme song from one of his podcasts in a bar and didn't recognize it. And that made me laugh too. He's like, oh, wait, I know this song.
I feel like this is like a Black Mirror episode with Spooky where his whole brain is changing and he's not used to humans anymore.
He's evolved. What if Spooky Dan is the next evolution of the human race?
He's videodromed himself.
That was a short that used to play on HBO called Slow Mo. And it was about a group of humans who moved at slow motion.
Oh, really?
I remember that back on HBO. In the 90s. Spooky Dan's the exact opposite of that.
But is he the only one? Call out to the audience. Do you listen to your podcasts at normal speed or sped up?
I feel
because you're conditioning your brain to think that we're...
That's very weird.
Don't you think back in the Killer POV days, I think we got one message of a guy saying he listened to it and spit.
Yeah,
and
I think it was Spooky Dan.
No, I think it was somebody, and I think they mentioned me being like that they wanted to listen to me at a slower speed.
You're just a series of punctuated syllables.
I learned to talk from Scorsese.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, you're like the New Zealand Scorsese.
He's my speech teacher.
All right, well, now that that's out of the way, all right, what have we seen?
Hey, guys, I finally watched Cold Fear.
Yes. Cold Hell.
Let you guys catch up first.
And by the way, I watched it as well because I had not seen it, but you guys really sold it hard.
Ooh. Yes.
Will it be approved?
Thank you. Cold Hell.
Hey, Ryan, let's listen.
I know.
Will it be approved?
I loved it. I swear that had this movie, the same visuals, been in an American movie that was not horror, this would have been like Academy Award grade cinematography. Like, that's what I was by far most impressed with. It was just beautiful. There was few scenes in it where I wasn't just like, oh my God, the lighting. The plot kept me throughout the whole thing, incredibly tense. And the actual murder, which Ryan described last week, where it shifts so that you realize that she's being watched, was one of the best
really
scenes
well
I've
done.
Seen this year. It was really well done, yeah.
Yeah, no, this is Shockwaves approved.
Whoa!
But second of the year?
Here's the thing. Yes. I think, and ironically, all foreign films that we're loving, the average horror fan is like, I don't like subtitles.
Wait, did everyone see The Ritual? Have we touched on that yet or not?
I think we were a bit mixed on that one. Oh, I loved it.
I liked it.
Wait, okay. Do we all like The Ritual?
I think we all liked it.
I liked it, yeah.
Oh.
Liked it, but does liked mean...
No, I don't think like is approved.
Shockwave approved is
that's
passionate
too, that's too
about.
Middling. We'll hold off on that.
No, but I honestly
it gets a
think...
I
got
limp
the sense.
Handshake. It gets the Shockwave's limp handshake.
Wow.
Someone's going to make a graphic for that now.
I got the sense that both you and Ryan really liked this movie, but I mean, I... loved it.
No.
Like, it is actually my favorite thing I've seen this year.
Oh, wow.
It hit all of my boxes. And I guess, I mean, again, I like those Korean revenge movies.
That was my as soon as I saw it, like. I was like, this is going to be Rob's, this is literally a South Korean revenge film. Like,
it is.
So similar.
And so, and I mean, the action set pieces, what I really loved, because I think some people obviously on our group had started talking about it after you guys mentioned it last week. And I was surprised by how mixed it was in the group, because people were like, I don't know, like, oh, plot lines meandered or this and that. I thought every character had an incredible backstory and arc.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Everything, like, added up and had a punchline to it in some capacity. And I love that we had that. And she's like, that actress is so mesmerizing and incredible. And like, The train sequence is my favorite sequence in the whole movie. Like, yeah. I jumped up out of my couch. I cheered several times, but that was the one that really got me. Yeah. Sierra, I think, had messaged me saying the same thing. She's like, yep, I was jumping off the couch in that same scene.
Mine was the taxi scene.
Which was also a great
sequence. That was one where I was, like, cheering and yelling at it. I wish I understand more. I loved the idea of nationalism in the movie and how it was this constant, like, oh, you're from Paris. Oh, you're Yugoslavian. No, that's a Bosnian restaurant. Oh no, he's killing Muslims. Like, there was this crazy concept.
Mishmash, almost like everyone's mixed
of
up
everyone
now.
Questioning everyone else's nationality, and some they trust and some they don't. It depends on who you are. You need to get your daughter into a German kindergarten. And it was, I wanted to understand it more because I was so kind of intertwined and wanted to understand that culture more. So I really liked that angle because it just kind of upped the anxiety of it, because it was this very much like you don't know who you can trust or who they are or whether or not they dislike you from the get-go.
You're such an intellectual. I liked it when she kicked the guy in the ball. I mean, that's all
well,
I could
that
see.
That too.
Or when a car blew up.
Things got stabbed.
But yeah, I agree also, with Rob about one thing when you said, like, we liked it because I really liked the movie, but I loved her.
Yeah.
And it's her
God,
character
yeah.
and her what she's trying to do is she reminds me of like the best thing of a Crank movie, but without the style of the movie, just that kind of drive of it. She has that in a better movie, which
and I
is
think,
cool.
And I think to back up the like, not love, it's just, I think there's just some narrative stuff. I think it loses its propulsion about somewhere in the second act because, you know, she's just trying to find a place to go.
That's when it gets into the, I call it the all men are skeezy segment.
Yeah.
For about 15 minutes
Well,
there.
She's like bouncing from family. She's trying to find a place to stay. She's she's got her niece and she's just going from one place to the other.
Her home life's pretty disturbing. It's kind of sad.
Well, I got to say, this detective, by the way, I called him German David Lynch. I loved him. He's amazing.
Exactly right.
I was like, I like this German David Lynch guy. Yeah. He's pretty great.
He was interesting.
So I loved it. Yeah. I loved it. And this is a Shudder exclusive, right?
Yeah.
So that's the only place you could see it, at least here in the U.S.
Yeah. Shockwaves approved. Cold hell.
Shockwaves approved. Another thing I was in love with this week that I know Becca also saw, I think the second season of Santa Clarita Diet is
it's amazing.
Terrific. Like, puts the first season to shame.
It blows the first season out of the water. And
I really enjoy the first.
The first season is great.
I mean, it's fun.
I like
it's
the first
fun,
one too, but like they really got their groove. They've got the, it's almost Evil Dead-ish in the absurdity of how gory it gets.
Oh my God, it's
and
amazing.
And then the humor. And and I don't want to spoil too much, but basically, because I'm not even done. I've been savoring it. So I'm
on
like,
episode
I'm over.
Six.
I'm about at six, too.
Yeah, it goes fucking off the rails. But there was one scene I actually snorted tea out my nose, which I
let's
you
see
know.
If it's the same one.
It was the scene, okay, so the living room's trashed.
Not
people,
too much, yeah.
People walk into the living room.
Oh, yeah.
It's completely trashed, and the boy's just sitting there, and he goes, "She broke up with me, and I'm angry," and he just pushes the lamp off the table. I lost my shit then.
Yeah, I was like, okay.
Fucking spoiler. Now we know a lamp falls off.
A lamp falls.
We're so sorry
I know.
I'm out.
That.
I'm
no,
out.
And then, I mean, it's just the they've expanded the mythology, which is total surprise because I'm like, oh, okay, now this is kind of interesting that there's a reason behind everything.
It felt like in the first season there wasn't. They were just making it up as they went. Like,
oh, okay.
Probably.
That's how it feels.
And I will say, it gets kind of, without revealing anything, it gets a little creature-y, which is designed by Clint Carney.
Clint Carney.
Yes. Which was amazing.
Good friend and artist of ours. But the one thing I wanted to reveal that I just thought just to give you a hint of the type of comedy it is at one point they end up encountering a character that's not a very nice guy, and they realize really they're admiring his shelves.
Oh God, the shelf scene was amazing.
Like, oh, we should get the shelf, and then they realize that's all Nazi memorabilia.
But
isn't
at this
it?
Point, they've been mesmerized
by
the shelf
so
for like
don't
a
realize.
Good minute.
And so then there's this giant debate between Timothy Fallon and Drew Barrymore, because she's like, remember when we said if we had to kill somebody, who's the worst person we could possibly kill? Nazis. We got one right here. And he's like, but I don't know about right now this second. It's like, no, this is a Nazi. I should eat and kill him. That's what we should do.
Nice.
And so the type of humor is just, it's really, like, the first season was good, and I enjoyed and I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if it's the same writing staff or whatever, but they fucking, like, hit it out of the park. The
like,
tone,
cool.
The humor,
I want to watch.
Everything's about it
great.
Maybe
I
already
finished
want
season one.
Yeah.
Oh, no, where were you on it when you stopped?
Four episodes.
When you hit Timothy Oliphant issues.
Timothy Oliphant is amazing in the second season because he gets crazy. crazier. He gets, it's, I don't want to call him zany because that's going to put Ryan off.
Oh,
but
love zany
he,
elephant.
He gets really like
zany.
He loses it because he starts it. I won't say
Ryan's
where he
the only one
it,
who prefers Jack yell, Nicholson but... Scream 2 elephant. You're like, I like it more serious.
Honestly, I do.
Which they actually this week on, he was on the Joel McHale show on Netflix now, and he and Drew Barrymore came on to do a promo for the Santa Clarita Diet, and they actually made jokes about how she was in Scream 1 and he was in Scream 2.
Yeah. I hadn't even thought about that. Yeah. Yeah, that's so, actually pretty
that's
cool.
Awesome.
Let's not leave TV then, because I know from seeing a tweet by the Turek that he watched The Terror from AMC, and I also watched the first two episodes of The Terror.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
Let's talk about it.
What is this? Because I've heard it, but I don't know what it is.
I know nothing about it.
So first off, Alec, do you have any history with the book?
I know I haven't read that, but I know other Dan Simmons stuff. So I was excited when I saw his name. I didn't realize initially they didn't advertise that. No. It wasn't until I was watching the credits that I realized.
I read about an eighth of the book.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, I've read
it a long time. He's got big books.
When it first came out, my dad recommended it to me. He absolutely loved the book. And I got about an eighth of the way in, and I just realized it was just too much because Simmons really laid the detail on thick. It's very historical, and I felt like I was doing homework.
What's it about?
It's about the Royal Navy fleet that's cutting through the Arctic Northwestern Passage. They're finding one way to the other. They're basically explorers.
I can't remember where they're trying to get to, though.
They're
trying to get to probably to claim a certain land.
Yeah.
But two of these ships.
It's the Erebus and the Terror.
And the Terror is
it's
the one
led by
in the
Terror, yeah.
Yeah, so and that's Jared Harris leading that one. Uh-huh. And the other one's the great actor.
Kieran Hines,
who I love.
Yep.
And they basically both these ships get stuck in the ice, and it's because of the
Jared Harris's captain, who is more seasoned and more recognized, and he's not as headstrong as Kieran Hines, who is more fame-seeking as a captain. He's
right.
Yeah,
part of it, though, is there's some sort of backstory that they have yet to reveal in the first two episodes, and I think it's going to explain some of the bad stuff that happened. Because there's a backstory that they were stuck in an expedition in the past, and you don't know exactly what happened, but I think it's going to be bad. Yeah, I'm hoping, like, cannibalism or something.
Well, what's nice is you have the two captains who are both very friendly. They're best friends, but they're, you know, in terms of a work level, they're at odds with one another because you got Jared Harris going, no, we shouldn't wait. We gotta, or no, he was like, no,
you
we should wait.
Around.
We want to circle around. Yeah. And then you've got Kieran Hines who's like, no, let's keep pushing through this ice. And he's like, no, dude, we keep pushing through this ice. The ice is going to solidify. Our ships are going to be locked in. And there is going to be a point in which the ice will shift our boats off course and possibly into land and crush our boats.
Yeah.
Like, that's how strong the ice flow is.
And it's so cold that it's for an indeterminate time. That's the kind of the cool hook of the show is these two boats are stuck, and one of them's like, well, we'll just wait it out, wait out winter and wait for summer.
Yeah.
And then somebody's like, the ice is getting colder. Even summer here is actually still frozen. And we might be here forever.
Yeah.
And there's like might be no way out.
And between
so
one
why
and
did
two.
They go there?
Because they're explorers.
They're explorers.
Oh, okay.
And there's a whole ship of people, so there's lots of big cast to possibly dispose of. The interesting thing about the show. Yeah, and all the comparisons. The only thing that bothers me a little bit is the comparisons are a little too soon that are being thrown around. Like, oh, it's The Thing meets Master and Commander.
Yeah.
It's definitely Master and Commander.
Yeah.
Like, I felt that straight away. It's definitely more Master and Commander than The Thing in the first two. But if it goes that direction, it's going to be the greatest thing ever.
It will.
I can't wait. Yeah. Like, the first two is very much set up. It's pretty slow going, but it's very. I'm totally drawn in.
Well, you're engaged. Because all the guys are great. I mean, like, all the entire cast is fantastic. And
it's very detail driven.
Very detail driven. Like,
how many episodes will it be? Like,
I don't know.
Because
Ridley Scott's
is it like a
mini
series?
I know it's not a full. It's not like a normal Walking Dead type show. I know it's a limited thing.
An event series,
but it can't be like four or five. I'd say 6 to 10. But there is something like something minor horror happens in the first two, but it's kind of in the distance. There's a great underwater sequence that I found very eerie.
Yeah.
There's a lot of eerie moments, but if they go all the way, this could be really great. Like
either
way, I'm in for the ride to check it to see where it goes.
Yeah, I mean, like everything is lavishly produced, you know, from the
AMC
food,
money.
The food, the food that they eat to the captain's quarters
too.
Yeah, Walking Dead.
You know, all of these things that work so well. Like, you know, I mean, like when they're pushing through the ice, I love that they disembark and they're actually physically cutting the ice for the ship, and they're laying
dynamite down to
blow up the ice so the ship can keep going through. It's really cool. And then, like you said, there is a kind of like a monstrous element thing that occurs in the first two episodes to keep you going, but I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those things. I can't tell exactly where it's going to head right now after two, which but in a fun way, like, you know, in a way that's kind of still exciting.
Yeah.
But definitely, yeah, production values are high. So I think if you haven't, I would, you know, as soon as they're available, I would check it out.
Yeah.
On the high production values, I won't say much about it because I want to watch a couple more episodes before I give it full coverage. But I watched the first episode of The Frankenstein Show on Netflix. Mm. It's really cool. I want to keep watching it.
Oh, what's it called? Like Detective Frankenstein or something?
Something like that. I don't even know. Frankenstein PI?
No. Or am I thinking something different?
I thought it was Frankenstein Chronicles.
Is it Sherlock Frankenstein? Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Something like that. No, it's actually the first episode. It's pretty snazzy. Okay. So I'm going to keep going. But I'll let
Frankenstein,
you guys know.
You know, Frankenstein PI was the original incarnation for I, Frankenstein. I'm serious.
Really?
When we were developing it really, really early on, I mean, like the whole hook of it was like, the Frankenstein monster was like a private detective in this, you know, the city of monsters.
Oh.
Yeah. And the Gill Man was an informant.
One fine day, we're going to have to get the Hollywood story from you on that one.
Yes.
On I, Frankenstein, man.
Well, instead, you're going to get my my lovely take on the Willies.
Whoa.
Oh,
whoa.
The 80s right. camping thingy?
90.
90. Okay.
1990 camping thing, yes.
It's an anthology?
It is.
I saw it during my Halloween anthology October.
Yeah, man. That is a weird movie. It's a Brian Peck, who's the co-star of Return of the Living Dead, wrote and directed it. And he pulled in all these favors to make basically a two-story anthology with a lot of throat clearing at the beginning. Because you've got Sean Astin and these two kids sitting under a tent telling campfire stories. And you're like, oh, is this how it's going to go? It's just going to be like gross out two-minute stories. And about for like 10 minutes, they're like, what's grosser than gross? Remember that lady that put a dog in her microwave? And then they're like, boo, boo, boo. And then you see a woman putting her dog in a microwave. She's like, oh, Poochie, I'm going to dry you off. And then the dog explodes. And you're like, okay, moving on. And then they finally get to the meat of their story, which is the first one's like a monster in a high school. But the monster wears human skin every once in a while and disguises himself. And then the second one is like some very unpleasant asshole of a teenager who by day loves to annoy his friends and his parents. And then by night he goes down into the basement and collects flies and pulls wings off of flies and then glues them into these like very elaborate sets he's created, like a little diner or hotel room. And when we get into the close up, we see these flies, you know, wriggling and writhing around. And then you hear like the sound effects that he's imagining in his head of like, hey, can we just order a cup of Joe, please? And I'm like, what the fuck is
that? That is bizarre.
It is very weird. And the story dwells on this kid for a long time.
That short is a mere hour long.
Oh my God.
You're like, Jesus. That's why I was like, it's only two stories?
It's only two stories. It's a fucking 90-minute movie.
It's one short. It's like the Campfire Tales. It's one short.
Yeah.
And then you're in the next story and you're just wondering where it's going to go. And then you're an hour in and you're like, is this the movie?
This is your story.
And then it ends, and you're like, that's the weirdest structural anthology I've ever seen in my life.
I know. And they end it with like a kind of a, you know, they wrap it up, the wrap around with like a little like, oh, shucks, you rascals. You know, there's like some kind of macabre like little twist.
Yeah.
And I am convinced Sean Astin was not under that tent talking to those two kids through most of the shoot, because all of the coverage was straight on Sean Astin.
No.
Straight on the two kids. Straight on Sean Astin.
So he only had a day on
and
set.
And I feel like only Sean Astin had like a day and a half, and all he did was just react to some PA off camera going, let me tell me your stories.
Got to get clean so we can like go off and do like a commercial or something.
No, it was very weird. And also I didn't recognize Sean Astin. He was in that kind of weird Goonie to, you know,
Lord of the Rings, like
Lord of the Rings age, you know, but there's
period.
A lot of there's a lot of cameos. I mean, James Caron has a part in it. Who else?
Clue's in it too, right?
Clue's in it. Yeah. Dana Ashbrook from Twin Peaks.
Yeah,
you know, there's just like and then there's the Kirk Cameron Growing Pains moment where the kid's looking at the TV. And he's watching TV, and then he's watching Growing Pains, but all the characters in Growing Pains break character and look at the TV and go, you're messed up.
Yeah.
And I was like,
so they had to get
Growing
Pains to do that?
Yeah.
Like they all agreed to it?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's yeah.
Alan Thicke is in Willy's.
And that is probably why Willy's is not out on, is it on a DVD?
No, it's just, it's a DVD.
Is that on a DVD?
I remember buying the DVD for like $6 or whatever. It's a fairly inexpensive DVD, but no Blu-ray or anything.
Yeah.
And even the DVD looks kind of questionable. I don't know why.
Off the VHS.
But yeah, there are a lot of interesting people in it, including Kimmy Robertson, too. So there's two Twin Peaks. It's like the Noah's Ark. They collected two people from every show or movie.
That's probably Brian Peck. Brian Peck, you know, probably knew all of these folks and just pulled in some favors.
Yeah.
So, the Willies.
I can't not jump in with a good segue here because one of the films I watched happens to star Dana Ashbrook.
Hey.
So I couldn't let that one slide. I watched, it looked like a HD version. I know this isn't on Blu-ray, but it was streaming of Return of the Living Dead 2.
Oh, wow.
And it looked great. It was on Amazon, and I have no idea why I pushed it. I mean, it's one I hadn't seen in quite a while because it was always harder. Directed by the great Ken Wiederhorn, which evokes laughter. But our name, it does come derived from one of his
movies.
Thank
you, Ken Wiederhorn.
For Shockwave's title. But this is one, I'll be perfectly honest, this is one I always remembered not really liking because I remember feeling like it was really clunky, and there's something about it didn't like. This time, I got to say, how I would describe this movie, part street trash, part Stranger Things, which is all good.
That's all I remember is
it's a lot of the kids running around on the bikes.
Finding them in storm tunnels.
And it's super gory, but in a comic, street trash gory, not scary gory at all. It's not scary at all. It's got some ridiculous stuff in it. It's weird for Wiederhorn because all his best stuff, it's kind of straight and serious. So him trying to do comedy feels a little forced, where that comes naturally to O'Bannon. But there are things in this that are just, Dane Ashbrook's great in it, and I didn't really like him as a young actor, even as Bobby always kind of annoyed me. In the new season, he's the best thing in the
he's
show.
Great in it,
you can't wait for more Bobby. But in this one, there's a scene of zombies driving a Jeep, which is amazing, where they're chasing a kid and they're just enjoying the act of driving, which I love. There's a part where a girlfriend of one of the main characters, when she realizes probably she's not going to get away and her boyfriend's never coming back to her, where she literally just says, okay, and lets him eat her head. And it is just watching that, made me almost laugh out loud.
The first one, didn't it?
The way it's done is so bizarre.
No, it's part two. Because part two, they did the Evil Dead 2 thing where 2 is a remake of 1. So it's the same actors.
Right. It's James Caron.
James Caron and Tom Matthews.
I didn't realize that as I was watching. I was really confused. I was like, why is he robbing a grave when he is the guy who discovered this in the first movie? So that part definitely took me out for a minute. Yeah. But then I was like, okay, there's something. It's obviously disavowed the knowledge. But it's on. Check out Amazon because it looks to me like that has to be an HD master. I thought it looked great.
Yeah, it says rent HD for $2.99 or buy it for $9.99.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed it and had a good time rewatching it. The humor doesn't always land, but the effects really do. They're a lot, they're nowhere near as good as the first in terms of kind of like the real naturalism, but they're goopier and kind of goofy, almost like more like through a perspective of a kid of what these things would be like.
I remember the kid zombie.
He goes to find his mom at one point. Yeah, I remember that part.
But I remember the Michael Jackson joke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't they? Because that's what I remember is they went overboard with the humor this time as opposed to the first one, which to me scared the shit out of me when I first saw it.
The first one
I didn't get humor from the first
return. No, I didn't see it as a comedy when I first saw it. I loved it, but it wasn't.
My ranking would still be 1-3-2, but. Because 3 is just a little more out there. And
what
kind
about
of,
4 and 5?
Rape from the Grave. And hey, they were shot in Chernobyl. Not enough of a song. But anyway, Dane Ashbrook's fun. So yeah, check it out.
Nice.
Great.
I went to WonderCon. So WonderCon.
Becca, anybody recognize you?
Yeah, I got two.
Oh,
I got two.
Cool.
And I wrote down their names because I wanted to say thank you so much for coming up and saying hi to me, Gabriel and Beth.
Wow.
So two people. And then I saw the Waxworks Records was there and a couple of our normal friends.
Make sure
were
that
there,
we paid
so.
Gabriel and Beth because I was
sent them in? You sent them go find Becca. There was two people came up and were like, you're Becca from Shockwaves. And I was like, I am. And then I'm always more excited than they are because someone has recognized me. So whereas they're like, it's cool to meet you. I'm like, it's so good to meet you.
Stop yelling at us and stop touching our face, Becca.
It's a good point to remind people to rate us on iTunes. Say nice things. I never read those, but I read them today, and one of them said, I met Ulrich at Texas Frightmare, and we walked down a hallway together. That was awesome. And I was like, whoa, all right. If that's all we have to do? I wish that's all I had to do in my relationships, walk down a hallway with someone.
WonderCon. This is the sister con to San Diego Comic-Con, and I had never been to WonderCon before, but I got invited to be on a couple of panels this year, so I was really excited to go. I'm always kind of hesitant to go to these giant Comic-Cons. I know I've heard people call them Pikachu cons because they tend to be kind of more catered towards younger audiences. But I love them. I just had a blast this weekend walking around, and I had my family with me on Sunday, and just watching Marnie get so excited over every single thing there. was just a blast. So yeah, it was a good time. But while I was there, I'm one of the weird people who goes to comic cons to buy comics and graphic novels. So I picked up two that I was super excited about. I picked up a bunch.
Especially interested in.
But these are the two that I'm the most that I read everything I got this week because I like binge read everything. But these are the two that I was most excited to talk about. So the first one is Queen Crab by Jimmy
and Palmiotti. I remember
Palmiotti. He's the guy who wrote Painkiller Jane and Jonah Hex. Mm-hmm. And this is nutty. It's very short. I don't know if it was ever intended to go anywhere else. It is about a girl who is, it's very much like this blue-collar kind of Brooklyn-y setting. And she is on a cruise with her husband. We kind of get this whole backstory of her and her friends and everything. And then she is on a cruise with her new fiancé. He throws her overboard, so he's trying to kill her. Something happens while she's underwater. She lives and crawls out into Coney Island with crab hands. Hmm. And then
joins
it's
the freak show?
Yeah.
Out there,
well, they try to convince her to. And she says no, and then it's just kind of like what she does from there.
Image Comics.
Yeah, through Image. And it is just wild. It never really gives much explanation. Like, you see this kind of abyss thing while she's underwater, and somehow that gives her the crab claws. But I want this to keep going, because I was so intrigued by it, and it was just... It's
a
unlike,
cool image, like her with the arms. Yeah. It's pretty badass.
It's unlike anything I've read before. So I had a really good time with it, and the art was just awesome. The other one that I really enjoyed is Goners by Jacob Saman. I'm going to say his name wrong. I always do.
From Dead Right Horror Trivia?
Yeah, from Dead Right Horror Trivia. He's also, this year, he wrote number one with a bullet, which mm-hmm. I've been really enjoying. But Goners, he wrote, I think, a year or two ago. But this one I read in one sitting. Absolutely loved it. It is about a family called the Latimer family. And it is set in this world where paranormal entities and monsters exist. And this one family has developed this brand of fighting these paranormal monsters so much so that there's a reality show about them fighting all these paranormal entities. And one night the kids are watching their parents on this reality show fighting these paranormal entities, and both the parents die very mysteriously on the show. So the kids are traumatized, and then they realize that something is now hunting them. And so now they have to, you know, they're with the bodyguard, their family's bodyguard, so they have to stay protected. They have inherited the family's entire fortune and brand, and they have to try to figure out who killed their parents. And so it's just, there's a lot going on, but it's a really cool story.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. Let's see. I'll jump into some Italian horror.
Ooh.
Yeah, I got. I picked up the new Arrow US release of Deep Red, Dario Argento's Deep Red.
Oh shit! Which cut are you gonna watch?
Well, I already watched it, I watched the Italian one, which is my not preferred one.
Yeah, longer.
I guess it's referred to as his director's cut. I think the problem, and it's not a problem really, it's that I tend to watch it with the English dub and subtitles, but because there's certain scenes that were cut out from the American version, it pretty regularly jumps back from Italian to English to Italian to English. Like, so it's a little jarring if you're watching it with that soundtrack. I'm sure if I watched it all Italian, it would be different. But I also still think, and this is just my general preference for Argento as of late, I've always liked the shorter American cut anyway, which I think was called like The Hatchet Murders or some weird title like that. I haven't watched that yet, but they're both fully restored. And no, it's a great disc. They already put this out in the UK because Blue Underground had done a Blu-ray version of it here in America. And I ended up keeping both editions because there's slightly different features on them. And this one has a couple of new ones. I ordered it from Diabolik DVD because the first pressing on all these Arrows are limited editions. Mm-hmm. And they never make it to Amazon, or they rarely do. And so I have peace of mind. I always order from Diabolik, and I always get the limited edition version. This one has, I think, the bonus disc with the American cut is kind of the bonus for it. And it comes with a booklet and a poster. I mean, they've been on a whole run of these Argento titles, including, you know, Cat of Nine Tails was a great package, and then Bird with the Crystal Plumage. So
this is one of his big movies.
Yeah. So they do these stellar, you know, sets for them.
I want to hear about the Sect one.
Oh, and that was next.
Okay.
That's by who? Scorpion? Or
Scorpion, mixed with Code Red. Here's the thing with The Sect, because I'd never seen this movie. This was, what's the guy's name
Michelle
again?
Michelle Sobey.
I love this movie.
I'd never seen this one, and I was excited because contractually obligated to get it out by a certain time, so that's why there's these single disc versions of Opera, The Sect, and The Church. And I only know I have a little inside knowledge because I've literally watched Jim Koons restore these things at his office when he's working on him. And the reason I skipped the single discs is because A, I knew that deluxe editions were coming. And B, I am a big subtitle guy only because I like to be able to, you know, my hearing isn't what it used to be. I like to watch with subtitles. And I don't think these single discs have closed captions. I think they just kind of the bare minimum to get them out, maybe a feature or two. So finally they announced The Sect as a two-disc deluxe edition with a slipcase, exclusive only through Ronin Flicks, which is kind of the website that sells all the Code Red Scorpion stuff. Ordered it, super excited, put it on, and it looks great. And it's about a two-hour movie. It's pretty long for an Italian horror movie. It looks great, but I only made it about an hour in.
Oh, no.
And
you didn't get to
really
the cool gore effects.
And got frustrated because there's a hiss that comes out of the back speakers. Now, from whatever little research I did online, and it's funny because the single disc, I would imagine it's just the same disc. From what I read up, the film is only a two-channel stereo mix, but it's but it's still, I don't know, it's the way it was encoded, I guess. What I mean is, like, you know, I'm trying to think of an analogy, but basically, if you turn on an amp and walk away and you just hear, like, that noise, just like that, it's not really a sound, it's just noise. That's coming out of the back speaker so loud, and the only dialogue is coming out of the center channel. And since the center channel is in front of me, I can't hear the dialogue as well because there's all this static noise behind me. And so I was so distracted by the sound, and I had the subtitles on, but the subtitles were actually in Italian translation, so they didn't match the dialogue at all. You know, it was like, it was, I just found it to be a very distracting experience, and so I ended up stopping an hour in because I was pissed off, and I was like, and also, you know, look, I mean, sometimes you get a good deal on these things, but these are limited edition deluxes, so it's almost like $40.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I was like, all right, I'm going to stop this for now. I'll get back to it again. I don't know if I have to manually turn off my 5.1 just to in order to watch this properly sound wise.
Would Jim know if you asked him?
Yes.
Okay.
I would have bugged him, but I
isn't
know
he's, he in Europe?
He's in Europe with his fiance. I'm not going to bug him. I'm not going to text Jim
while
he's
in Paris. Yeah. You know. No, you're
Jim,
in Italy,
man.
But
what's up with the sound, man?
I got a hiss, man.
I'll wait for him to get back to get the full scoop and see what he says and report back to
well,
you.
Well, make
guys.
Sure you make sure you do watch it because it is cool and it goes.
It goes really cool places.
And I want to.
Yeah, you got to finish it.
I was hoping maybe it was just my disc, like maybe, but I haven't really gotten a clear answer from people online that have picked it up. In terms of other than hearing that, oh, it's recorded in like two channel stereo, anyways. So that was kind of a bummer. But I hope that I can get back to The Sect at some point because I love Cemetery Man. So
yeah,
oh yeah,
it goes to really neat places.
And stage fright.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
The church. You haven't bought the church yet?
Church? No, because the only one that's come out as a deluxe has been The Sect.
Okay.
The church and opera are just single disc versions, but they're both coming as deluxe editions, and they'll be exclusive from Ronin Flicks.
Okay.
I always thought The Church was a little slow out of all
I love
of his.
The church.
Really?
Yeah,
maybe
yeah.
I need to rewatch
it. Especially if you rewatch it again, thinking of it as like the third Demons, it really works as that.
Yeah.
Like
yeah,
it really
much.
Has okay. that back, and it kind of gives you, goes back in time to the.
It's just very nightmare. Guess, well, the Knights, the
Knight
Templar
Templar
Knights,
stuff.
Crusades.
But it does
stuff,
have some gory stuff.
When
I was
disturbing.
Young, I thought it was slow, and I didn't like it that much when I was young. But then when I started like 2 years ago, same time as Sect, I liked it a lot.
See, I remember seeing like Sect. Stage Fright and The Church, like all within the same month, because I was on like a Sovavi kick.
Yeah.
And I found The Church to be the slowest of them. Yeah, so I need to go back and revisit that one.
I mean, The Sect is pretty slow too, though. But, I mean,
I don't know. It's got really good like effects moments and really good kind of what the fuckery moments that keep you going. So.
All right. Some
what
new
else?
Stuff. I got a few more. Insidious 4.
Oh,
the last
I saw that.
Key.
You know, there's some stuff in here I like. In terms of creature stuff, I like a lot. This one's dark. And I think I had an interesting reaction because this is a franchise I love. And I won't feel bad at all because this movie did great. And I love this as a franchise and I want more Insidious. But it's really dark and disturbing material. And there's a part of me that really missed part two, bonkers movie making, like the crazy and zany comedy, like the zaniness of that film, I felt like was missing in this one. And I was like, oh, I want more holy fucking shit. And I think what it is, and it makes sense because this story goes back and really ties the whole series together. So it's integral to the story. Like I think, you know, fans of the series are going to like this movie. It's not in question. It's more like, what do I want from my Insidious going forward? And I wish somebody in this room would listen. Here we go. No, I'll tell you what I want.
Give me a a pencil.
He wants more Purge and Predator.
This is actually pretty simple. This is pretty, I want more further. I want to go all the way into the further and really push that and find out more. I feel like
you
this
did.
One,
you went so deep into the further in this one. Albert.
I felt like this one had the least of the further and was more like, you know, it explained some interesting. The key monster creature stuff is awesome.
Key face, yeah.
That stuff's really fun. And you know, it's interesting. It's also cool that you have like a 70-year-old woman, you know, leading a franchise. Uh-huh. That's pretty badass. Uh-huh. So I don't know. There's just, for me, there's something about, also maybe I think, by going backwards for two movies in terms of story, sequentially, there's a part of me that now has got really like amping, like, all right, the story's over now. I really want to see an Insidious that's set contemporary and let's keep going.
Further in the further.
Let's go further into the further. That's all I'm saying. I didn't come here to complain.
Sinister crossover.
Hashtag
I didn't show up to Blumhouse today.
Further into the
I just want somebody to listen. Let's go further with this and go back to a little more bonkers. Let's have a little more fun. I think this one, I get why, because also I think the director, obviously, he suits Dark Material, mm-hmm. like in line with Deborah mm-hmm. Logan. But for me, there's something about that French. I think that suits Conjuring more. And I think one of the fun things about Insidious is that kind of zaniness that they kind of really established with two, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so I enjoyed watching it, but I want to go crazier with it. That's all I'm saying.
All right. We'll give you more cross-dressing.
Hey, all right.
I'm surprised you haven't seen this film yet. Maybe you have.
If you know where you're going, take a look at that
word
right
there. Talking about
Pie Wacket?
Boom. Bam. Wow. Elric and I are in
sync. I know.
And I've always just watched it when I then see you tweet about it. I'm like, oh, I just watched that.
Yeah.
Rob and I did Santa Clarita and Cold Hells.
All right. So, all right. We'll take it.
Well, Pie Wacket is a film that came out from IOC Films. It just hit VOD. Backcountry writer-director Adam McDonald is back with a film that is, not Man versus Nature, but now Mother versus Daughter.
And some Mother Nature.
Yeah.
But
here he's tackling like the kind of strenuous relationship between mothers and daughters, especially when grief is involved.
Yeah.
And here you have Nicole Munoz playing a teenage girl who finds her life completely upended when her mother, played by Laura Harris, who's obviously grieving over the death.
Wait, Lauren Hutton.
No.
Her mom.
No, Laurie Holden. Laurie Holden.
Yeah. From Walking Dead.
Yeah, Walking Dead.
The Frank Darabont movies.
Yeah.
And Jump Cut Cafe.
Yeah. And Laurie Holden's character, her mom, basically is like, enough is enough. I can't live in the same house as, where we were a happy family. We need to move. So she relocates her and her daughter to well outside of town, which means that her daughter is incredibly upset, and rightfully so, that she's leaving all her friends behind, all her, her school chums behind. And in an act of rebellion, she decides to put a death curse on her mom.
Yeah.
Using witchcraft. And
yeah, it's funny how like when you put it as a plot, and I was thinking as the setup, there's plot points where I'm just like, what?
But the funny thing is like you say that, and then immediately I'm sure like listeners are like, well, what a bitch. Like, how could you do something like that? But the funny thing is like he makes it feel very natural because it's just a teenager lashing out.
Teenage feelings are different. Like
I would have cursed my parents at some point.
And you think as a viewer, you're like, that shit's not gonna work. Yeah. But then creepy shit does start to work, and it does start to happen, but directly to the daughter. And he does a really good job with it.
Yeah, basically, this is a movie like where the setup, there's like a couple of the character beats that I didn't totally buy. I didn't totally buy them as mother and daughter. And I think part of it's just Laurie, the actress. Like, she's good, but her hair is also perfect every morning. When she wakes up, she's got the perfect curl. Little things like that. But when the horror elements of this movie kick in, I love that. Yeah. It's really, and it's not that predictable, I think I kept waiting for certain predictable beats, and then it would do something a little off and a little strange, and there's some crazy reveal towards the end.
Not even just in the horror, but in the drama as well. You'd expect them to come in on a scene where you're like, oh, this is the big showdown. But it's already happened.
Yeah.
And you're kind of coming in the after effect of whatever big moment happened, and you're like kind of seeing these characters react to the dialogue. It's a movie that lives like really on like a lot of the quiet moments of frustration and anxiety and grief and desperation. And it works. I think it worked really well. Like, yeah. Really kept me in there.
No, yeah. I, on a filmmaking level, I enjoyed it a lot. It's one of those things that's a couple beats, just things short of being like a great movie.
Yes, yes, yes.
But and that's and it's no one's fault either. It's not like any. It's just sometimes the pieces together. But yeah, man, where it goes is really cool. And there's a couple creature beats. There's something on a wall that I found really effective. Mm-hmm, I won't spoil too much. Yeah. It's definitely an intriguing horror and ticks all those slow burn, you know, creeper vibes.
I watched it really late at night. I was just kind of like hanging out in bed, just relaxing, and I had all the lights off. And that moment that you're talking about, it made me sit up, and I was like, "Oh, now we're getting somewhere really unsettling and filled with dread." And it was very impressive as like an indie supernatural thriller, and I definitely recommend it. You know, somebody on Twitter was like, "Well, it wasn't all that great." I was like, "Yeah, but you could still recognize that it's a good movie."
And I would say it might not be great, but I think there are great moments in it. Uh-huh. And I always think if there's like two or three great moments in something, it's worth discussing.
Yeah.
I think it has that horror wise. Yeah.
And I thought the girl, the daughter, Nicole,
she's really good.
She's really good.
Yeah, she's really good because she's really nice and believable. And some of the interactions with the teenagers at times was like, what? Like there's a guy and girl, and they just never. It's like, come on, hook up. Come on, we're in the back of the car. Let's do this. But they kind of dance around each other almost too much for me to
not
believe.
Everybody has to hook up, Elric.
I just got straight to it, man.
I was going to keep sitting here reading Queen Crab.
Queen Crab. Now, Elric promised to do something this week, and he promised on Twitter.
Did it happen yet?
Did it happen?
So let me break it down. Let me set a scene. I'm at home. Yes. Okay. Yes. I'm eating nuts and watching Fandor.
Like you do.
I'm on my Fandor, and I push the Fandor button.
Wait, did you say eating nuts?
Eating nuts.
Just to, you know.
I'm eating nuts, like watching Fandor, hitting my EpiPen in my chest, in my heart, and half watching them. You know, I'm doing ironing. I'm
of
not
course,
really.
Yeah.
you don't iron anything.
I'm full Beckaing at this point. I watched something called Inside Number 9.
Oh, you did?
Started first season on, because the other two, I mean, I just wanted to start in first season, and that one was through Shudder. I had to decide where to jump in because what had happened like a long time ago, when you first talked about it, I had pushed play once on the first episode in the first few minutes. It was all messed up, something wrong with my streaming, and I kind of was like, oh yeah. So I didn't want to jump back in there. I started with one, I think it was one of your recommendations, episode 2, A Quiet Night In.
Yep.
Sorry to disappoint you, Becca. Genius. Like fucking these guys. Fucking
what a setup.
And I'm not talking like it's okay. Yeah, it's pretty good. No.
It's brilliant, is it not?
This first episode, this is the one to start on. Like, and actually, there's a one I like even more, but this is the perfect one to start on because what I go in going, oh, is it going to be like Black Mirror? Is it going to be like what?
No.
This is like nothing.
It's better than all of them.
It's basically a 25-minute silent film, even though it has sound, where no one talks, as two guys try to break into a house to rob an art painting. And it's hilarious because these two guys are trying to – there's a gag with a dog that I like – I don't think I've laughed this loud in a very long time as they're trying to get rid of an annoying dog from a scenario.
I howled,
and it's actually freaking hilarious. So this was a great one. I watched that one and was like, oh, my God, I love this. How am I going to ever live this down to Becca, knowing that I actually listened to her and she was right about something? It's disgusting. I'm going to send you peppercorn.
Which other ones did you watch?
Because
now you have to watch all
of
them.
Tom and Jerry.
I love that one so much.
Which is really fun, and it's about basically a guy who comes home, notices the homeless guy across the street, and says to his girlfriend, don't go near that guy, I don't like that guy. And then one night, you know, it's really cold out, the homeless guy knocks on the door and says, oh, could I, you know, oh, you left your wallet, and here's your wallet. And it's like, oh, thanks. And he's trying to get rid of him, and he's like, oh, I guess you could come in for a quick drink. And then basically they start living together, and then he starts becoming the other guy.
So weird.
And it just goes on this, it goes somewhere where you're like, holy shit, this is insane.
And did you see the ending coming? Because I was completely blown away.
It was great. Yeah. But then, so I watched those two, and then Dick Renner came over, and I said, you got to watch, because it's totally opposite. More, even more than me, this will become his favorite show. Like, if you like comedy, horror, those elements, and I just happened to pick the perfect one, the last one of that season where they're in the haunted house
thing. Is that not amazing? It's called the Harrow.
This is
Halloween?
The Harrow. The other one that, if you were going to start, this thing, it's because this one's firmly horror. It's basically total last house. Starts like House of the Devil.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically the babysitter comes. She's from high school.
But it's an elderly man.
Yeah,
and there's a bell. He has a bell that he'll ring.
There's
if he
somebody
needs
up there. Don't worry, he's elderly. He has a bell, but he'll never ring it. Don't worry, but he does have a bell. And if anything went horribly, but it won't happen. You know,
and
it's
so
like
you
this
spend
is the setup.
The first half of the episode just waiting for the bell to ring, and it's amazing.
She
tension.
Invites her friend, and the place is a total horror show. It's like all the most disturbing paintings on the wall that you've ever seen of hell, images of hell. And they're like, we're just going out. We only go out once, and they look like, you know, vampires almost. But the setup, you're like, oh, how could this get crazier? And then of course, you know, her friend comes over, and then the bell goes and they have to go upstairs, and it is fucking rad. It has an amazing ending that's actually creepy. Like it goes from being funny to genuinely creepy in the last beat. So this isn't a horror show per se, but this is a horror episode. Mm-hmm. I've watched those three, and I started watching one, and then I was on solo duty, so I was gonna watch the whole first season before I came in, but I'm like, I still have a couple to watch. But it's the kind of show where I will definitely watch every episode. That's
yes,
how good it is.
You
so
need to.
Hats off to Ewan, is it Alan? And his abuse from
There's
inside
a lot
number
of
nine
people.
Tweets.
Yeah, but Alan's one of the main ones.
We appreciate it. But this is really something I think people have a lot of fun discovering the show. It's really cool. I don't know if we can watch the other seasons.
Yeah, actually, 1 and 2 are on Hulu now, and you can buy 3 on Amazon. And I think
like
it was
Brit
like
BritBox or something. Weird.
Through BritBox, I got 1, 2, and 3. And you definitely, and BritBox, like, it's like Shudder where you can get like the free week or something like that. And even still, it's like $5 a month. So like we had it for a long stretch because I binged all of Fawlty Towers and Are You Being Served and League of Gentlemen and Psychoville are also on there. So it was like worth it just to watch all of those.
And it's cool because it's two guys who write them all, just like Charlie Brooker did on Black Mirror, and they both act in most of them. There's a couple that, you know, they go a different direction.
And a lot of times they'll use the same actors over and over. So it's really kind of interesting
but
to
the
see
episodes
where they
are
end
nothing
up.
Alike.
Nothing.
And I think that's what won me over. I was like, oh, wow. And there's only 6 episodes. So obviously it's just super high production value in that British way, only 6 episodes. Highest recommendation.
There are so many episodes that I'm so glad you're finally watching Elric, because there are so many episodes that I've been like, Elric would love this. There's literally an episode in the 3rd season called Diddle Diddle Dumpling, and it's about a man who's walking to work one day and he finds one shoe outside of his house and becomes obsessed with finding out what happened to the other shoe.
I've actually thought
that
before.
And that's literally the only...
That's funny.
But it goes in the zaniest... Like, it completely goes bonkers. But that's the only point of the episode is to find out what happened to the other shoe.
Okay, cool.
And I've watched that one and said, Kane would be into this.
Yeah, no, it's really fun. I think Rob will definitely... some of the comedy bone in you, I think we'll dig it.
No, I'll jump into that too.
Thanks,
too.
Guys. It only took like 3 fucking years.
That is about my turnaround with your recommendation.
I will say this. And Becca, I'll reserve all my thoughts for later on, but I started reading Hex.
Are you liking
the
it?
The book.
My God. My God. Like 3 years later. What is up? Literally, it's like the second episode.
Years,
no.
Like
no.
Months.
It was seriously like the second episode of Shockwaves that I was like, Ryan, you got to read Hex. Because it was like right as we were starting all up right, Blumhouse.com. So are you enjoying it?
I love it.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It's great. Yeah.
Fuck all of you guys.
I feel like that's how we do it with Becca. And with Becca, I think you take things we talk about, Killer VV, and then you go, I just discovered this thing. And I'm like, I talked about that 3 years ago. I think that's just how we roll here.
Oh my gosh.
Ryan, have you caught up with Ash vs. Evil Dead yet?
No.
Okay.
No.
It continues to be terrific.
Awesome.
I'm a little sad because we're at the halfway point now, and this could very well be it. I just am in awe of how many ways they find, how many ways they put Ash in unpredictable predicaments that are wonderful. Let's just say that there's a baby child demon version of Ash now.
Oh, my God.
And
catch up. I'll catch up. I'll definitely catch up.
It was really funny this past week.
How far are they into it?
This is the 5th episode just aired. Yeah.
So
we're at the halfway point.
I didn't get Showtime this time, so.
I do not Showtime, Stars.
Oh, Stars.
I just use the app via Amazon Prime.
And you can subscribe and unsubscribe it
for like a couple bucks or whatever.
Yeah, it's like $5 a month. And I'm catching up on American Gods as well because I never
finished
that. I started rewatching Boris Karloff. Thriller anthology series. It's really solid. The first episode was Leslie Nielsen, who plays this kind of corporate executive who catches the eye of this woman that works in this building, and she basically is like, hey, so I'm in love with you, and I've been watching you every day since you've been working here, and I think you and I should definitely start a relationship. And he's like, I'm sorry, ma'am, but I'm married. Meanwhile, there's this kind of mailroom chump who is on the rise, or so he thinks, and he's also eyeing Leslie Nielsen as someone to kind of emulate, and soon enough, both this mailroom creepo and this creepy chick come together and really disrupt Leslie Nielsen's life.
That always happens to him in horror. Leslie's always on the downside of his relationships.
I know. But it's cool because it's like, you know, I mean, like the show was made around, I think, like around the era that Mad Men is emulating, you know, that Mad Men was set in. So it's like, you know, I was kind of imagining Leslie Nielsen in a Mad Men scenario.
Sterling Cooper.
Like, oh, yeah, he could totally fit in. Yeah. But it's a cool show. It's a cool show. The ending of this very first episode is a little lackluster, but I remember there were some really good episodes in that. In that whole box set,
did you pick up the box set, or is it?
I've had it. I think it was Image that put it out like a couple years or several years back, and I've just had it, and I haven't watched it in a long time.
There's probably a site that tells you which this is the five episodes. You know what I mean? To take that shortcut sometimes.
Yeah, but and then I just got the Outer Limits box set, which I cannot wait.
I remember Leslie Nielsen being, and I think it was just a pilot that never got done, but it was, I want to say 70s, and it was like a Lovecraftian thing, and he was playing a detective investigating Lovecraft crimes, or it may have been a cult.
That was Fred Ward.
No. I'm telling you. There was the Leslie Nielsen one. I remember it. I think it was like a TV pilot that never went anywhere, but it was good.
That's cool.
So I got it. Someone out there in the ethos is now going to tell me exactly what it was.
He knew, like a midget at a urinal, he'd have to stay on his toes.
Naked Gun 33 and a third. That's one-liners of the whole
show. Like a blind man at an orgy, I'd have to feel my way around.
Nice.
I love those ones.
That is a great one. All righty. Well,
okay.
Wait, no. I have a big one to end.
This is
my dedication to Rob G.
This is bigger than Inside Number 9.
Okay. I spent $5.99 on Invitation Girl.
Oh, really?
So I'm not going to...
You're ready to talk about it now?
Yes, because I was going to put it off.
I was going to save it for Texas Frightmare. Or, sorry, for Chattanooga.
No, because it just came out. We want to help him not wait 3 weeks. The reason I did it, actually, I wasn't going to watch it, but then I realized we wouldn't all be together for like 3 weeks because we're going away to...
Oh, that's true.
Next Chattanooga. Week we don't have a show. I think that this movie, you're right, this movie's definitely up my alley. Because it's not really a horror movie at all.
Nope.
Right? It's a art house indie sci-fi. You know, that would pretty much tick it. Definitely American indie in that sense. I think it's really original, and I think it's a really I liked it a lot. Like I found I was really interested in it. It was definitely the kind of movie I probably would have talked about on Pure Cinema or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it's a different. I mean, obviously for your slate, I'm glad you got it through because it won't be the obvious kind of movie for them to put out, and I think it will be a harder sell because of that. But in the same token, I mean, it's not like Under the Skin or any of those movies, not really stylistically at all. It's a lot more minimal. It's also more about human connection, which I really like. She basically, I mean, you've already talked about the story, but like, you know, the goo comes down from space and, you know, attaches itself to the cover of a Playmate.
Lauren Ashley Carter,
and then kind of forms itself into her, and it's really interesting. One of the best images is just her as she becomes this thing walking through the middle of the desert on a highway, but the guy she kind of ends up meeting who runs this motel, that stuff's the stuff I really like found myself like responding to because it was very warm in its approach. So it's not, that's why it's not really a horror film. It all the characters are so, I don't know, warm to each other, and then even the porn star character is like starting to doubt what she does and think about her life, getting existential about her life, is then suddenly seeing in mirrors like this image of this woman who's coming, and you know it's slowly about the two characters coming together. So I'd say set people's expectations differently in terms of like, is this horror? No, if you're somebody who likes these kind of movies and like more offbeat indies, but they have really original voices and you can see through the budget, you can go, okay, I know where it's being pitched.
Yeah, for a first film, I was really impressed. Yeah,
it got my attention. I was interested the whole way, and I was like, I didn't know where it was going to go, and I liked that quality to it. So
right, of everybody here, I knew you would be the one.
Yeah. No, you weren't wrong.
When I was watching it, I was like, this is going to be an Elric pick. And really, the thing about it is, I want it. Look, you have access to a brand that you're building from scratch, you know, at least this movie label version. And I thought it would be a bold pick to really throw expectations aside. So far, the one thing I keep hearing is everyone's like, I watched it expecting dread to happen, like the whole time, like, where's the horror element? I'm like, it's not, it's just a good movie. Yeah. And if I can use a cool horror label to get good movies out, then to me that will...
I think you guys can talk about it as sci-fi because genre, you know, extended so, and it's clearly sci-fi. It's not horror at all, but it has sci-fi. Actually, I'd say The Last Beat kind of has an element of that, but it's really, it is sci-fi, but it's the whole way, it's sci-fi in that indie way where it's trying, I mean, similar in a sense Under the Skin and not in terms of the way it feels at all because that's the dread version, but about what the character, if somebody trying to understand us, you know, and trying to understand a place. And that side of it is good. Also, it's a good performance by her, especially actually playing the thing. Like, I think yeah. she's really interesting. And I don't know, I thought it was cool, man. Hats off. I enjoyed this one. And as I've always sworn, I will always be honest with how I feel about these.
Beautiful. You know? Well, so, that's Imitation Girl's available for rental now. So yeah. please follow Elric
yeah.
Suit. We have no problem selling these Terrifier DVDs and Blu-rays. Everyone's into the
It might take
clown.
Me longer to get to that one.
Okay. Yes, but yeah, we could show love to both.
Yeah, yeah, so. Cool.
I appreciate that. Cool. And yeah, Natasha's doing a horror movie next, so we'll get
okay,
to
cool.
pick her brain about that.
When she comes
and
in.
Yeah. We'll be back with our interview right after a word from our sponsors. Today's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Shudder. Brought to you by AMC Networks, Shudder is not only a premium streaming video service, but an experience unlike any other. Created for fans of all degrees of thrillers, suspense, and horror, Shudder is home to the largest and fastest-growing human-curated selection of high-quality, spine-tingling, and provocative films, TV series, and originals. There's always something new and unexpected for Shudder members to explore. Premiering on Shudder this week is the critically acclaimed dark comedy Mon 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 Monsters. While doing a school-mandated community service, a bullied boy and his tormentors discover a creature. Claiming her for their own, the kids keep the creature captive, revealing the monster within themselves as her ferocious sister scours the city in search of her missing sibling. Mon 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 Monsters is a wild, left-of-center coming-of-age story with horror, gore, and dark comedy. Variety calls Mon 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 Monsters savagely funny, a social horror movie. Find out for yourself today, streaming only on Shudder. Shudder is available for $4.99 a month or $49.99 with an annual membership. But our listeners can get a free month by entering promo code SHOCK at checkout. Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of thrillers, suspense, and horror available to stream anywhere.
This week's Shockwaves is also sponsored by Wellgo USA and their newest remastered Blu-ray release of Ichi the Killer. Simon Abrams at RogerEbert.com says you won't find better conditions to watch Ichi the Killer under. Takeshi Miike's Ichi the Killer has endured as one of the most influential pieces of genre filmmaking of the last two decades, and now it returns in a stunning, all-new, digitally restored special edition approved by Miike himself. Ichi the Killer Definitive Remastered Edition available now on Blu-ray and digital at Amazon.com from Wellgo USA. For more info, visit www.wellgousa.com.
And just a reminder, we still have a few days left in voting for the Rondo Awards, which we are nominated under number 18 for Best Multimedia Site, which is kind of what we are, I guess.
Awesome.
But either way, we appreciate the vote from you guys. It's something that would be exciting to bring it. Shockwaves hasn't won this, even though we've been nominated, I think, for the last 2 years. So you go on there, you'll figure out how to use the form. Rob, do you want to weigh in on that?
It's rondoaward.com. And then you click to enter the site, and basically all you have to do is copy and paste the email, taraco@AOL.com. It's taraco@AOL.com. Just put in 18 and vote for Shockwaves. You don't have to do all of them.
But as big fans of all the horror stuff going on in the year, it'd be awesome if you took the time to do it.
Welcome back to Shockwaves. I am really excited about our guest this week because growing up as a female horror fan who really wanted to start pursuing horror filmmaking, especially in the 90s before we had a thing like Google, it was damn near impossible to find female filmmakers who had actually made horror films. And when you start researching them, and we were using books at the time, literally there was like four names that came up, like Roberta Findlay. I discovered Maya Darren through this, and then Stephanie Rothman. And so to be sitting next to her, somebody who I discovered as a filmmaker when I was in high school and you know, had researched back then and watched all of her films is just absolutely amazing. So welcome to the show, Stephanie Rothman.
Thank you.
Hi. Hi, welcome.
Yeah, Stephanie has an amazing career working under Corman, working within horror and exploitation, and then you worked at Dimension for a while, so I'm sure we will get to all of that.
Oh,
but
boy.
Yeah.
Not Harvey Weinstein's Dimension, Dimension Pictures.
That yes.
preceded him.
Yes.
They took the name after Dimension Pictures closed down.
Right.
But we're going to go back to the very beginning. So you're from Los Angeles originally, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Were your parents part of the industry?
No.
Wow. So and you started out studying sociology and then kind of gravitated into filmmaking. Could you talk about kind of how the path came about and what really attracted you to the filmmaking field?
Well, I was a student at UC Berkeley, and I went to the movies one night, and what I saw was The Seventh Seal, and I was just bowled over by it. I said to myself, I would like to make a film like this, but I had no idea how to go about making films. Even though I grew up in Los Angeles and my family was acquainted with some people who worked in the industry. So I came back to Los Angeles and I got a job which had nothing to do with film. And then I started dating a fellow who was a cameraman on TV. And he had through, you know, just sheer ingenuity and self-promotion become a cameraman. But I didn't think that this was a path that I could follow. And so I asked him, is there any other route? And he told me about the USC cinema department. And so I went down there and I was admitted and I became a student there. And I learned how to become a filmmaker. And when I finished my work there, I had a few months of unemployment. And then thanks to the Roger Corman calling the cinema department and saying, I need an assistant, I was sent over. And he hired me. And that was the beginning of my short filmmaking career. It lasted 10 years, but that's all.
So early days of Roger Corman, what were you doing there? Like, what were your day-to-days like?
Everything. I read scripts. I went out and shot second unit footage as a director for films that he was financing. I visited as an associate producer other sets. He was really a one-man studio at that point. And so
this is like the mid-60s, right?
Yes, that's right, the mid-60s. I went to work for him in, I believe it was, the fall of 1964. And I worked with him through January or maybe the spring of 1966, and then our paths crossed again in the early 70s.
Wow.
He's one of the few producers at that time who was giving real opportunities to female directors or female filmmakers in general, like because it extends into his Slumber Party Massacre series and stuff. Is there something about Roger that set him apart in terms of how he like cast people in roles and key positions that sets him apart?
Well, someone once interviewed Roger about why he hired a woman director. I love that question.
Yeah.
And his answer was, because she was competent. Hmm. That was his standard for everybody,
Their
competency. If you proved incompetent, then you no longer work with Roger. If you met his standards, then you continue to do so. He was not at that time, to my knowledge, maybe you know something I don't, hiring women directors. I think this sort of thing came somewhat after me.
Yeah, I think
I,
was, yeah, quite a
I was the first,
yeah.
And at the time the only, in the mid-60s.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you see many other females working, not just in the industry, but in the exploitation and horror industry? Was there more than one or just kind of you?
Me.
Wow. That did you take flack for that, or was it just kind of within Corman's world, was it just kind of like you're competent and so you're accepted?
Well, I mean, I was accepted by Roger.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave me the facilities and the power to do this, and so who was going to give me flack?
Yeah. That's.
If they gave me flack, they'd get fired.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah.
So the first one that you directed was Bloodbath, right?
Well, I co-directed it with two other directors.
Mm-hmm.
I know Jack Hill was one of them.
Yes, he was the middle one.
Uh-oh, who completes this weird sandwich?
Story.
Where do we end?
The original footage was shot in Yugoslavia.
Oh.
Well, Roger was making a film over there himself, and I don't know the name of the director, but it was a European director who did it. Roger brought the footage back, and he didn't think it was suitable for an American market, either for theaters or for television. And so we hired Jack Hill, and then I came next after that.
Oh, so you were never writing and directing together. It was separate. Okay.
No, we just shared credit on the screen. I completed the work. I shot about I had to write a new plot to somehow unify the old footage, which, as you can imagine, was very awkward.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, this is not a masterpiece we're talking about. And I managed to do that satisfactorily enough for it to go out and play as a second feature in theaters and also on television. And Roger had just been praying that maybe he could sell it to television. So he was very satisfied by that.
I'm just curious on what in your past set you up to, like, write? Because in terms of writing, you're just jumping in as an assistant to Corman. Was it the time at USC Film School, or were there other things before you got there that actually set you up to be a creative, somebody who could solve a problem like that creatively?
Well, I learned screenplay format at film school, but I was always a writer. Mm. I mean, I worked earlier in writing capacities, so it wasn't a problem. And, of course, I spent my life watching films, and I had also taken some acting lessons and performed in some plays. So I was familiar with, you know, how dialogue was constructed and what sounded convincing and what didn't and what was natural and what was unnatural.
Right. At what point did you get the freedom to create something, you know, from scratch instead of just inheriting elements from Roger?
The next film I made was a complete feature financed by Roger. It was a beach picture. It was called It's a Bikini World. Actually, the working title that it had was The Girl in Daddy's Bikini. But apparently, when Roger sold it to AIP, the American International Pictures, they didn't think that was a very commercial title. So they changed it to that. So that was the first feature, complete feature that I shot. And I think it was one of the last beach pictures, if not the last beach picture. And as I like to say about it, I like to think I killed the genre off. However, it had some well-known musical groups of the era in it, The Animals and... I'm sorry. I forget the others.
Yeah,
but some of them are very well known. I mean, and you can see them on YouTube. In fact, you can see excerpts from all the musical numbers in that film on YouTube.
You're right. That is a subgenre that definitely is dated to a modern audience. I find that the movies stop, and then music starts, and then the movie starts again. And I find that for me, that's one of those subgenres I've never been able to kind of fully immerse myself into.
Well, that's musicals, though. Yeah. All musicals are like that.
I know, but some of them, like La La Land and stuff, keeps you going into the narrative. The narrative continues as part of the song. You know, sometimes Umbrellas of Cherbourg, some movies are able to do that. But the beach movies, it's something I can't understand. I don't know.
Well, I think that the beach movies are not comparable to,
to Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
Major musicals. Yes. I think to even utter their
the existence. I should be banished.
Yes, absolutely.
By the cinema police.
Yes.
They have their own set. It's very much like a formula thing, too, where they had set things that you had to include along with the beach movies, correct? It felt like horror in that regard, where like there was always a certain amount of love and, you know, some type of, you know, romance that had to be involved with it.
Yes, that's true. But that's true of all films.
Yeah
it is, actually.
Now, were these movies being made for the drive-in market?
Yes.
Okay. So, again, that's part of maybe it doesn't matter if people aren't watching the movie during the song sequences. I don't know. I'm assuming there was a make-out quotient to these movies, I'm assuming. I don't know if you built them into it. But.
No, I did not construct the screenplay.
around teenagers.
Teenagers making out.
But well, they know what to do.
Yeah.
Well, one thing in common between Bloodbath and It's a Bikini World is Sid Haig is in both films.
Oh, he's in Bikini World.
I mean, I've always loved Sid in general, but even from that period, I always thought he was such an interesting actor. So was he somebody that was just kind of working in that world or somebody that you picked to be in It's a Bikini World? Or what was your relationship with Sid like?
First of all, I agree with you. I think he is a fine actor. And secondly, I liked him the moment I met him. But actually, he was cast in Bloodbath by Jack Hill. Mm-hmm. And when I saw him, you know, his role in the Jack Hill part, I thought he is somebody who could be carried over into mm-hmm. the part that I'm doing because obviously we need some continuity. Otherwise,
make this thing work.
Right. Exactly. So, and then my co-writer, Charles Swartz, who was also my husband, and I were writing It's a Bikini World, I thought of Sid as playing the character of Daddy, who owned a club where all the kids gathered and where all the musical numbers took place. And he was excellent. I mean, you know, Sid knew what to do. Sid was one of those actors. He read the part. He knew what to do.
He's also in Beyond Atlantis, one of the later ones you wrote.
I wrote the story.
Yeah, he went to film school with Jack Hill, actually. They went to school together. I remember interviewing Jack a long time ago. It's kind of interesting.
And then Spider Baby. And,
yeah, it all keeps going.
Some amazing stuff. Talk student nurses, because this is kind of one of the first ones that you were writer, director, that like you helmed the bulk of it. Or was that Bikini World?
Wasn't the bulk of it. I did the whole picture. I directed the whole picture.
Yeah.
Bikini World and everything I did after that. Mm-hmm. It was just this one, mess that Roger had when he, you know, tried several people to improve that I worked on mm-hmm. something that other people had worked on.
Yeah. So going into student nurses, where did the concept come from? What was kind of the market you were pushing towards? And talk a little bit about the experience.
Well, student nurses was the idea of regional film sub-distributors who, along with Roger Corman, when he founded New World Pictures, agreed would be a commercial subject. The reason they thought that was because the previous year that a film had come out called The Babysitter, and it was very popular with audiences, and Roger said to me, I never saw it, it has nothing in it, it's worthless, but, you know, that's a very catchy title, and the sub-distributors think a film about student nurses is the same way. Nurses, as we all understood, are a favorite sexual fantasy of men. And one of the reasons being, of course, because they get to touch men. It's perfectly all right, and so that is makes them an object of fantasy. And so there, you know, are many pornographic films made that are this nurses, that nurses, etc. So
news to me, Rob. News to me. I can't believe it. I'm in denial.
So anyway, I got together with again my husband who produced it. And the story editor of New World, Francis Dolan, the three of us came up with a story for it. And then we hired a very good young writer who was just coming out of UCLA Film Graduate School named Don Spencer, and he did the screenplay. And meanwhile, we hurried to get ready to make the film because we only had 2 months between when we started and the film had to be shot.
Was that standard for Roger, that it was such a quick turnaround?
Well, in my day, there were quick turnarounds, yes. I can't speak for after my day there, but yes, you didn't take a lot of time. And especially because this was the first film financed by New World, and they wanted it out for the late spring, early summer. And we were only getting started in January.
Oh, my goodness.
So, you know, we had to start shooting by April, and then we had to cut very quickly. So that's the story of the student nurses, unless you want to ask me other questions about it.
Well, you know, a lot of these are consecutively very close together.
Yeah.
So in this time period, were you just going from film to film? Was it kind of nonstop at this point?
Well, for the next film that I made for Roger, yes, it was. And that was the horror film you're referring to, The Velvet Vampire. I did have a little more breathing time then. We had a little more time to write the screenplay, scout locations, cast, and shoot it. But I did go from the student nurses immediately to the Velvet Vampire. And then after that, we left New World and went with Roger's partner in New World, a man named Larry Woolner, to his new company, which he had found financing for and started. And within the next year, I made group marriage. We made group marriage, I should say. And after that, it was like 1 year apart that I would make another film. And so then came Terminal Island, and then the last film I made, The Working Girls.
I wanted to ask about Velvet Vampire, because that one seems to have an actual European film influence on it. Mm-hmm. I feel like whether I know if it was around the time of Jean Roland or if it's more coming from Bergman, but compared to the other films, which feel more like exploitation films, I don't know. Was there anything that was you had visual influences for that particular film?
You've seen all my films?
I haven't seen all your films. I've seen that one and Terminal Island. Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, I think if you looked at all my films, you would see there is a European influence in all my films, because that is what influenced me to want to become a filmmaker. I watched European films. I really liked them, and I wanted to make European films. Mm-hmm. And since I landed in the world of exploitation filmmaking, I tried as hard as I could to make European exploitation films.
And they feel like it, yeah.
Or European-influenced ones, let me put it that way.
Were there horror films that ever influenced you on those films, or were you less interested in what was happening in horror at the time?
You know, actually, The Velvet Vampire is a kind of, detour from the normal thrust of the rest of my films. I made it because I knew I had to make an exploitation film. I knew I had to make a genre film. And I thought that here would be some interesting visual possibilities that, couldn't be explored in these other ones. And you're right. I did try to do some, more visually interesting things with it. But to say that any one person influenced me to do it is not correct, because, it was just years and years of watching European films.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And also, knowing the potentialities of the camera and having my own, visual imagination. And this seemed like an ideal subject in which to express all of this, or bring all of this out, or do it, I should say.
Do you feel like with any of the films you have, a film that you're most personally connected, where you feel like you most were able to express, even within the exploitation, because I know you're working within that framework, did you feel like with one of them it had the most you in it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, actually. The last film I made, The Working Girls, I made it for less money than the others. I had to go terribly fast. But I had also learned a lot in those years, and I was able to do, again, a lot of things that I wanted to visually. A surprising amount of that film is handheld, and this is before Steadicams. And in addition to that, I wrote it by myself. I had no co-writers on it. And it was about a subject that I found very interesting, which was underemployment and employment for people. I know it has, a very, very suggestive title. And, of course, that was deliberate. But it actually is about underemployment and getting types of employment that you were neither trained for nor want. Mm-hmm. And I'm fondest of that.
Were you always like aware with, because the good thing about exploitation films are, yes, they have the catchy thing to grab and pull an audience, but they always do seem, the good ones do seem to be always about an idea seems to be in there that you're trying to slip through. Some people were able to get political with ideas. Obviously, Roger himself occasionally had ideas. Like, were you conscious of that when you would be writing these scripts? And obviously the last one, but just throughout your career, were you always conscious of?
Of course, yeah. The Student Nurses is an extremely political film. Yeah. You haven't seen it.
I haven't seen Student. I mean, I know I've seen trailers of it. It's one I'm aware of. I just haven't seen it.
Yes. Yeah. Well, yeah. It might interest you. Yeah. It might surprise you.
Yeah, I'll pause Terminal. Now and go watch it.
No, Terminal Island, I remember having lot of social issues, a lot of gender issues in there. There was a lot going on in that film.
Well, that's true in The Student Nurses, too. Mm-hmm.
Well, Terminal Island, you both have the big thing I discovered today I didn't realize is you have two cast members of Magnum P.I. Well before Magnum P.I.
Yeah.
Do you think this is what set it in motion, I wonder? I don't know.
I have no idea.
We watched Terminal Island in my graduate film program. It was shown to me by a professor in class when we were doing, I think it was a gender studies class, but we watched Terminal Island as part of the class and then studied it and discussed it, and it had so many different issues going on to unpack in there. So just a really heavy film.
In prison films, I guess, at the core, there always seems to be something inherently political about that period.
This was not a woman in prison film. This was a Devil's Island film.
Right.
It had people who were prisoners of both sexes in it. Some of the main characters were women.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm not, you know, saying
I guess it's a prison. Yeah, prison film.
It is. And sometimes people say, oh, it's a woman in prison film, but people who look at it see it really is not.
Yeah.
It has much more to do with how people who are have committed crimes so severe that they have to be – that they're exiled to an island, learn to either fight and destroy each other or build a new society.
Yeah,
it does. It's got a definite kind of adult version of Lord of the Flies feeling to much of it. So it's a really powerful film. I highly recommend it.
That's a very astute observation on your part.
What? Sure. Yeah. She called me astute.
Absolutely.
So tell us some of the films that have influenced you over the years, some of your favorite ones. I know you brought
up... Becca gave you homework.
Yeah, I gave her homework. I said, because, you know, I've always been a big fan of Stephanie's Terminal Island, Velvet Vampire. I definitely cited two of my favorite films. I wanted to know some of Stephanie's favorite films. So I gave her homework to bring in some,
I hope it wasn't
some of
too
her
hard.
Topics.
It was a pleasure.
She gives us homework all the time.
All the time. I'm like, guys, do it. Do it. I'm grading it this week.
It was a pleasure. It really was, because it made me remember all the films that I've had such joy with that, you know, I've learned so much from that just are like old friends, and I got to go back and visit them. Mm-hmm. And I probably signed like the Criterion catalog.
Elric's, if you hit the Criterion, Elric's going to love
everything. Problem,
So, yeah, let's hear some of them. And you even divided them up by nationality?
Well, yes, I did. and through the years, too. You know, I'm going to start, interestingly enough, with American films, if I may.
Yes.
Sure.
It's funny. I love films that are set in the 1930s, but there's no particular one that I'm really fond of. But you get into the area of film noir, and there are a number of them. You know, I belong to the film noir herd, you might say. So The Postman Always Rings Twice, Double Indemnity, Out of the Past, In a Lonely Place. And then we go into the 50s, and there are two films that I really like from the 50s, The Sweet Smell of Success, Alexander McKendrick.
I don't think I've ever seen that one.
Oh, you must.
And he taught at USC towards the end of his career, yeah.
I thought it was UCLA.
Oh, I don't know. I thought
I think it was UCLA. But anyway, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, which I think has such a lesson in it. And it's not just about, you know, the West or the American West, but actually about truth and fiction, mm-hmm. you know, or legend and fact or whatever you want to call it. I really do like Godfather 2. I think it's a superb film. Okay, now, from there, it seems only appropriate to jump into Italy.
Yes.
Okay.
We've spent a lot of time on Italy this episode so far, yeah.
All right. The Knights of Cabiria, Casanova, and Amarcord, from Fellini. All three from Fellini. Yeah. And then, of course, Antonioni L'Avventura, which is just a marvelous film. Ugh. And then Visconti's The Leopard. Which
Burt Lancaster.
Which is not only one of my favorite films, but also one of my favorite books. Yeah. And when I was in Sicily a few years ago, I went and visited the palazzo of the author and went and visited the cafe where he hung with his friends. He wrote a remarkable book. He really did. I don't know if you've ever read
it. No, I've only seen the film.
I strongly advise you to read The Leopard, really. But I know we're talking about film. Okay. All right, so the English film that has always most moved me is The Red Shoes.
Yeah.
And that's because I trained as a dancer. So,
Don't
go by me.
and it's visually magical.
Yeah,
the sequences the shoes
is.
Are just
it's
astounding.
Absolutely
it is.
Gorgeous.
And it's a passionate film.
Yeah.
It really is. I mean, I think that it really conveys an artist's passion marvelously.
Yeah.
As very few films ever have. All right, well, here we are in France.
Okay,
great.
And what a lineup of it I have here. One of my favorite films of all times is Jean Renoir's Grand Illusion.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And then I really like something by a director named Jean Grémillon, who isn't even remembered anymore. Pardon me, I have to take a sip.
By all means.
That's
this might be the first one I haven't heard of because
so far
I've been with you, but this one I don't think I've seen any.
Yeah, this is like all Elric's favorite foods here.
But this one I'm not familiar with.
He was a very popular filmmaker of the 30s. He was one of the kinds of film directors whose films the New Wave rebelled against.
Right. Makes sense.
And then, of course, there's Marcel Carné, again, one of my favorite films of all time, Children of Paradise.
Beautiful movie.
And Le Jour se lève as well.
That one.
Then there's Henri Clouzot, and he made the most furious, angry, film I've ever seen. It's called Le Corbeau, The Raven. And it's rarely shown. It was made during World War II, and the Germans the German occupation was on now, and they loved it because they thought it was an indictment of the French. But actually, it was a hate song to the Germans. What can I say?
I've seen Wages of Fear and Diabolik, but I've never seen The Raven.
Yeah.
So
yes. Well, The Wages of Fear, of course,
it's
and Manon are my other two favorites of his. Yeah. Diabolik is a marvelous film, but I'm not much of a horror film fan.
The irony
of it.
Yeah,
wow.
Truly. It's Then there's Julien Duvivier, Under the Paris Sky. And then we come to, again, perhaps one of my, no, not perhaps, one of my favorite two films, Orpheus by Jean Cocteau, where a poet falls in love with death. And death reciprocates.
Some of the best photography.
That's pretty horrific, if I remember it correctly. I mean, I remember it being a beautiful
poetic
film.
Horror,
but poetic horror.
Well, I would just call it poetry.
Yeah.
And then someone you will know who did make horror films, Georges Franju.
Uh-huh.
The Eyes Without a Face. Mm-hmm. What a marvelous
films,
film.
Oh, my gosh, I'd say that's definitely one of the top 100 of all time.
Yes.
Shockwaves approved.
Shockwaves approved, definitely.
Wonderful film.
So, Francois Truffaut, what can you say?
Uh-huh.
All of his films, but I especially love The 400 Blows.
Yeah.
And also Shoot the Piano Player.
Yeah.
Now, there's a great romantic film. Yeah. Wow.
Good noir.
So these really just range all time, but they all kind of have a very poetic feel to them, I think. It's like across the board. So.
Well, that was cinema at that point.
Yeah. We talked at the top of the show.
That was French cinema.
Yeah.
And by the way, it still exists today. I mean, I love French films today. They manage to create an intimacy with the viewer that no other school of filmmaking does, in my opinion. Okay, then there's Jacques Rivette. And he made two things that I really love, which is the first one you probably haven't seen, Paris Belongs to Us, which is a very, I think it was his second feature, very paranoid movie, really interesting. And it conveyed the kind of anxiety all of us had in the 50s about what was next after the horrors of World War II and the threat of atomic war. There was this kind of malaise. really, it is an appropriate word here that settled on everybody. And it was made about France. It was part of the temper of the times everywhere, including the United States. The depiction of America in the 1950s is an innocent time, and everybody is being, a dumb conformist was not true. Far from it. Okay, so
was the other Celine and Julie Go Boating?
Yes,
because I love that film. That's my favorite of Rivette's film.
I love that
That's
too.
A really amazing
I film. Share it with you. Okay, then of course there was Godard with Breathless. Who couldn't like Breathless? Yeah. But the other Godard film I liked was his feminist film, and God knows he was no feminist. He really he hated women, I think. That's my view. But it was Vivre sa vive.
Oh, yeah. I had a jump cut. That was the giant poster. Remember?
Oh,
the
you
black
did
and white
have
with
that up.
Anna Karenina as the prostitute. And
Her Life to Live.
Yeah,
yes.
My Life to Live. Yeah, yeah. It's a beautiful movie.
And
it's in chapters, which is interesting. The way it's structured is great.
Yes. And it really is a feminist film.
Yeah.
Okay. So now I'm just going to skip over to post 2000.
Yeah, I'm intrigued.
That's
so,
a big leap.
Yeah,
1970
giant
to 1967.
I'm intrigued, what you were watching now that really gets you excited.
Right now?
Or post 2000.
Or post 2000.
Now. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
There was one other film, and it's an American film that I forgot to add, and I do want to now, that is one of my favorite, and that is Paths of Glory.
Oh, yeah.
Stanley Kubrick. Mm-hmm. Paths of Glory is a ripping film, and it is relentlessly clear-eyed and appropriately cynical. It's a wonderful film.
And it's nice to have you say that, because I feel like of all his movies, no one really talks about
that
film.
I've never seen that one.
They always overlook it, I think, for easier, Dr. Strangelove about war.
Right.
Yeah, no, that's good. It's beautifully constructed, too.
Ugh.
It's,
beautifully acted.
Yeah.
Looks beautiful.
Yeah, it's good.
I'll take it.
Yeah.
Okay, so America, post 2000. There are three that have always stood out to me. The first is Million Dollar Baby.
Mm-hmm. Clint.
The Hours.
Nice.
And Up in the Air.
Oh, interesting.
Which was such a delightful surprise. Such a socially aware film. And so melancholy, and was such a perfect ending,
Definitely one of the best Clooney performances. So natural in that film,
yeah.
It felt like it got to more who he might really be. I don't know, as a character. It's,
I think you're right.
More revealing, yeah.
Yes. Now this year, what I looked at, I saw all the screeners because I belong to a union, and the two films that I liked best were. We're both ignored.
That always happens with the Oscars, doesn't it?
Yes.
The ones we love.
Yes.
Phantom Thread was the one I loved, and that was totally overlooked. So.
Yes. The two that really gripped me were, first of all, Detroit.
Oh, I still haven't even seen it yet.
Oh, okay. It is excruciating. It's beautifully done. Naturally, nobody wanted to see it because it's
heavy.
Pain from end to end, but it is worthy of witnessing.
Okay,
I think it's the best film about the black experience that I may have ever seen.
Wow.
Wow.
The other one is The Florida Project.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really
my students love that.
Made. Sean Baker's a really great director in general, I think.
But it's a wonderful film, and it's about people living on the very edge of homelessness. It's about poor people, people without much formal education, who've made mistakes in their lives, who live in this combination motel and apartment building, whose manager is Willem Dafoe.
In one of his most natural performances of his career. Like, we've never really seen him play that kind of person.
He plays a good man. He plays a good and conscientious man. Yeah. And the main characters in it are the children. And their attempt to break out of this limited world in which they live, and how, at the end, at least one of them loses everything. It's a terrific film. I hope it has a second life.
And there's a performance in it that I was talking about on the other show that no one really talks about. They always talk about the little girl, but the mom, her mother in it, gives this very, like, it's electric. And you don't know if it's who she really is or if it's what it is, but it's really not talked about enough, I think. She's really something in it.
She is wonderful in it. Yeah. I agree completely. They both are. They're wonderful.
Yeah.
And I hope it has a second life. In streaming and in DVDs or in whatever, I really do. It deserves it.
Yeah, it was really overlooked by the end of the awards because it did great in all the other awards, but then it got to the Oscars and nothing besides Willem Dafoe being nominated. So, yeah, I'm sure it will because his films. I think people are discovering his work after Tangerine and other films like that. So.
Well, Stephanie, you actually have your name on an award this year because
Stephanie
is working with me on the Stephanie Rothman Fellowship for Female Filmmakers, which I kind of came up with the idea that I wanted to do something literally like on this show. I think I walked in one day.
Aren't we part
like,
of it? We're approved.
Shockwaves are definitely part of the big sponsors for it. But I literally like walked into the show one day and was like, guys, I'm pissed off. I want to make a scholarship. What can we do? And so we combined forces with Etheria, reached out to Stephanie. And this year we are giving $5,000 away to a female filmmaker in school. So it works like a fellowship. And we've had some amazing applicants so far, and we're going to be...
How long is it still open to?
I think it's open for another 2 or 3 weeks. But if you just Google Stephanie Rothman Fellowship, like it'll come right up, and you can apply there. And yeah, I'm so excited that we were able to make you the namesake of it.
Well, I'm honored. That's all I can say.
Thank you so much for joining us on the show today. It has been phenomenal talking with you, and thank you for having such a phenomenal, inspiring effect on female filmmakers and filmmakers everywhere in general. So, thank you
for giving me one hell of a list to catch up on.
Yeah, no doubt. I just wrote down like
quite a
titles.
Handful of those I have not seen yet.
I have one final question for you because we started with Bergman, but he wasn't on that list. If you were going to tell the listeners one Bergman film that you would really...
The Seventh
Okay,
Seals.
So back to the one, your first film. Okay. Yeah. I wasn't sure if that was your favorite. I just knew that was the one you saw in theaters.
It is my favorite film, along with Orpheus.
Yeah.
Those are two of the most remarkable films.
So if you've watched two from those as a starting point, let's go with those.
Seventh Seal, Orpheus.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. It will blow you away. And if they don't, there's nothing wrong with the films. There's something wrong with you.
That's what I always say.
Kane tells me that all the time. Yeah.
Finally, I have evidence. Thank you for that. I appreciate
my
it. That's
pleasure.
It's been fun hearing about these films.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
Guys. We will be back next week. The three quarters of Shockwaves will not be here.
We'll be in Chattanooga.
We will be in Chattanooga recording a live show with Joe Bob Briggs.
Yeah.
Yes.
And while we are gone, Ryan's going to be taking the show in our absence. He's got some absolutely amazing guest planned, which I'm really excited about.
Blumhouse-related?
Yes. Blumhouse-related, yeah. Some
just
really
you
cool.
could narrow it down. What's coming out?
What's coming out?
Blumhouse.
He's got some of those guests. It's going to kick ass. And then we will be back the following week, and we'll be sharing our Joe Bob Briggs episode from Chattanooga Film Festival, where we are discussing the weirdest films we have ever seen.
That's the lineup.
Yeah, it's going to be nutty. Okay, guys.
See you there.
See you then.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.